Putting it through a device and rectified the visit directory, which throws out a choppy, sometimes noisy signal, and it's not a pure DC. So solar panels produce electricity that's exactly what your battery wants to see without any kind of filtering or static in the way. The mount, now we also have to have a mount. You know, these things kind of hold onto your wrist while you're doing 55, 60, 70 miles an hour. Sometimes you get the headwind, passing trucks that will hit you and shake you. So mounting is pretty important too. Again, the wire harness is what carries the electricity from the roof to your controller to your battery. And this is where most people try to pinch the pennies, and this is where you shouldn't, okay? This is where you need to pay somebody to know what they're doing, understand voltage draw, understand safety, and pay them the amount of time it takes to pull wire to do it right. Because I guarantee you bid people against each other and get the cheapest, I'll do it for $50. I'll do it for $120. The problem with those is the guy who's doing the install, it's to his advantage to finish as quickly as he can and get on to the next one. And you're going to find out when we start talking about wire harnesses, where I told you most of the problems lie, that if you go for the cheap install, you end up paying more because you have to pay someone to undo it and do it right. And in the process, you probably have to drive way down your way to find somebody who knows what they're doing. So this is not the place to save your money. Most of the solar places you go to try to sell you the panel by the watt and don't pay a lot of attention to the critical stuff. So this heads up. I know too many people that have prepared wire harnesses that ended up costing a set of batteries thousands of miles out of the way once they have to redo it right, and it ends up costing more. So this is where you don't cut corners. Now, charge controllers, you're going to find out that in the RV world, solar is a fairly small segment of the total RV or out there that uses it. And then in the scope of the worldwide use of solar, RVs are like this micro dot. We're like way less than a tenth of 1% of the users of solar. So if you're a manufacturer, you're not necessarily focusing on the needs of an RVer. You're making something like 70% of the controllers and solar made in the United States are exported to third world countries to run vaccine refrigerators, well pumps, criminal lawyers and villages and things like that. So anyway, we can make a lot of those parts controllers work on RVs, but not all of them are designed for the operating environment of an RV. So that's the components. Now let's talk about some of the things you consider. Solar panels may operate at a higher voltage than normal, at a higher than normal temperature when they're laying flat on the roof of your RV. Most solar panels are dark blue to black cells. And their powering is rated at what's called standard test conditions, which has very little to do with real-world operating conditions. It's a manner of testing things in an equal environment, so it's easy to compare one brand to another. But that doesn't directly relate to the real world. When they test these solar panels at standard test conditions, they have a cell temperature of 77 degrees or 25 degrees C or 77 degrees Fahrenheit. And if it was 77 degrees outside, and your car unit is dark blue to black, and there wasn't any wind blowing, would you lay your bare forearm on that hood? These things operated twice to three times standard test conditions, especially when they're laid flat on the roof of an RV. When they're tilted up, like in a remote home or or a grid interconnect system, and the panel gets hot, hot air rises, you have a floating panel, that hot air rises, cold air comes in behind it, and operates at a cooler temperature. Now this thing is laying flat on your roof, baking in the sun, with a frame around it, with stagnant air, superheated stagnant air under it, they're running really hot. And they're going to have a voltage drop. So when you get into the panel, we'll close on explaining why I recommend certain voltage panels. Another thing to consider, I've already alluded to this, the vast majority of system failures are in the wire harness. Again, I alluded to the controllers. The use of inappropriate charge controllers that don't take into account a few things we'll discuss in the kitchen charge controllers are going to either A, not finish charging your batteries, or we're going to boil your batteries dry. And we'll cover that in more detail. And I want to talk to you a little bit about batteries. Solar power, solar panels are battery charged. Probably the number one question I get is, can I run my air conditioner off of your solar panel? Right now, it doesn't compute, okay? An air conditioner runs off of alternating current. Solar panels are battery charges. They operate the 12-volt battery range, okay? If you have a converter that takes that 12-volt battery and sets it up for household current, you can run microwaves, TVs, VCRs, DVD players, curling irons, hair dryers, blenders, toasters, vacuum cleaners, drills. If you want to operate that stuff, you need to get an inverter, which has nothing to do with solar. We're talking solar today, okay? I could spend a whole other hour and a half just on inverters. But if you want to run that other stuff, then you need an inverter. Solar is a battery charger. The 12-volt systems in your rig, so your lights, your fans, and your water pump. Now, batteries, they call 12-volt batteries, but a fully charged, blended lead-acid battery at rest is generally 12.6, 12.7 volts. That varies a little bit depending on the type of battery. But to fully charge that battery, you have to push it up to 14.1 to 14.4 volts. Every battery manufacturer in the land tells you you have to reach capacity threshold in order to fully charge your battery. The exception to that would be cell phones. They don't want you to hit capacity threshold because they're sealed. If you would push water out of them, you can't add it back in. In my opinion, cell phones aren't appropriate for RVs because they're very sensitive to their charging algorithm, and you can have a multitude of charging sources in an RV. Your vehicle driving down the road has an alternator. You might have a converter on board, so when you plug in the shore power, it charges. You might have an inverter that has a charger in it, and it has a different way of charging. You may have solar panels. So you might have three or four different ways of charging batteries, and you need a battery that can accept a little range of voltages and not be such a tight restriction on voltage. So that is why I think gel cells are appropriate. So we're going to mainly talk about the flooded lead acid batteries and the newer absorbed brass mass steel batteries. But anyway, you've got switches to this gasket gel cell. Here's what's happening. You have lead plate floating in a dilute solution of sulfuric acid. When you are discharging the battery, in essence, you're pulling the sulfur out of solution. It's moving over to the lead plate. When it gets there, it gives up an electron. Moving electrons is electricity. When you are recharging a battery, you have to drive all that sulfur back into solution. If you don't, it'll stay behind on your plate, and slowly start turning into hard rock sulfatum and start growing like a cancer across the face of your plate. And that does two things. It weakens the electrolyte because some of that sulfur is no longer in there to make sulfuric acid. had it removed that portion of your plate from interacting with the electrolyte. You will know you have plate or sulfated battery plate when a battery that used to last you 2 or 3 nights barely makes it overnight and it recharges real fast and goes down real fast. That's almost a sure sign that you have sulfated plate. It's saying, hey, you're not finishing the job of charging your battery. You're not hitting those points regularly. The other sign of hitting 14.1 and 14.4 is called the gasing threshold. Once you hit those kind of voltages, you're delivering a little bit more amperage to the battery than it can absorb. And those amps have nothing better to do but run around and tear water in half. H2O, they tear it into hydrogen and oxygen. And that's the bubble. You're not boiling your battery like boiling water. You're ripping hydrogen from oxygen and making bubbles and excess up to the surface. Now, if you have a pitcher of water and you open a can of orange juice, concentrated orange juice, and you dump that in that pitcher, call that the concentrated sulfuric acid, you dump it into the water, and you stir that all up, pour yourself a glass, take a drink, walk away, come back in a couple of hours, and what do you usually find? You'll see the pulp has settled to the bottom. It might be a little darker orange at the bottom and more water at the top. Well, sulfuric acid weighs more than water, as does concentrated orange juice. So if you don't stir up these batteries on occasion, you're going to get stratified electrolytes. Pure sulfuric acid on the bottom, pure water on top in an extreme case. And simply heading for every truck hole and going fast over railroad tracks is not the way to stir this up, okay? You have to generate that gas bubble. That gas bubble will rise up through the column and stir the electrolyte up. So it's real important. This is batteries 101 in 5 minutes, okay? I could spend another hour and a half on batteries alone. And if you want to hear that, go to a Life on Wheels event. And we do inverters and batteries and solar all hour and a half left. We're going to try to just bring you into solar here, but you have to understand this about batteries to understand what I'm going to tell you about solar and what's appropriate to what I need. Bottom line here is temperature extreme. How many of you have insulated climate control battery compartments? Okay. Well, this gasing threshold I'm pointing out up here is 14.1 to 14.4. That takes place at a battery room temperature, which is 80 degrees Fahrenheit. They always operate slightly hotter than the air around them because the chemical reaction inside is what's called exothermic. It gives off heat. So they're always slightly warmer than the air around them, especially when they're charged. So what happens if you're 100 degrees outside and your car's on blacktop that's been baking in that sun for a while? What temperature do you think your batteries are at then? So that gasing threshold that gas at below 14, when it's hot outside, that moves down to 13, 7, or 8, depending on. For every 10 degrees Fahrenheit, you need to lower, if it's hot, if it's 10 degrees hotter than 80, you need to lower that set point about a tenth of a volt. The colder it is outside, you go the other way. You need to raise it a tenth of a volt. So if your charging systems don't have what's called temperature compensation, in the warmer weather, you need to pay particularly close attention to your battery's water level, because if you take a battery up to this kind of voltage when it's hot outside, you are actively driving water out of your batteries, and you need to replace that with pure distilled water, not trick water or something. It needs to be H2O going back in because that's what came up. Out of your tap, you got calcium, magnesium, chlorine, and who knows what else. And you dump that in your battery and that introduces impurities.
So anyway, chambers are kind of safe and is important. We'll cover that more when we get to the charging facility. Let's talk about the solar panels. Right now, conventional, commercially available common three types. The amorphous, which means no discrete grain boundary. If you've seen the solar power calculators, you see these red, brown little squares across the top. That's amorphous technology. You have monocrystalline. I'm going to skip the polycrystalline. It's easier to explain. You'll look at a solar panel and it'll be kind of sparkly blue, different shades of blue, and it's like multi-crystals weaving all around, kind of like a pot of water that just froze, or thin layer of water in the driveway that froze. You see these little crystals running everywhere. Well, polycrystalline means more than one crystal. Single crystal or mono crystal panels are going to just be a uniform dark blue to black looking type of a cell. And I have some pictures coming up here. We're going to talk about what affects the output of the solar panel, and then we're going to learn how to interpret the labels on the back of the solar panel. These are those three different types of cells. The sparkly blue was when you're partially blue ones, they're the polycrystalline, the more uniform looking ones, they're the mono, and then the amorphous, you can't really see any distinct grain boundaries. These have an amorphous silicon, are about half as efficient as these, meaning it would take twice the root area to equal the same power. Okay, and remember I told you efficiency is to be desired on the limited real estate of our division. Monocrystalline as a cell, this is a cell, is slightly more efficient than a polycrystalline by about 1%. But these are very fragile cells, and then you'll see that the corners are not complete. You see these little white diamonds between them. There's nothing going on there because there's no solar cell there. The polycrystalline one can be sliced into squares. So even though they're slightly less efficient as a cell, when you're talking about a solar panel, they're equivalent because this has a better seal. So between these two are essentially equal when you're buying a solar panel. And they're priced about the same. There's minor differences in operating voltage and things like that. But as a rule, either one of those is fine. So let's look at what affects output. You know, panel is going to put out some voltage and it's going to put out some amperes. So let's talk about voltage first. The number of cells in the panel is what dictates its operating voltage. Each of those cells, whether it's the size of this floor, so the size of the tip of this pin has a voltage potential of about a half a volt. Some are a little less, some are a little more, but for easy understanding, let's call it a half a volt. So if you need to take your batteries up to 14 volts plus a little, then you've got to have enough cells to generate that kind of voltage. Traditional panels nowadays are about 36 cells. And they generally operate somewhere between 16 to 18 volts, depending on who makes the cell. We recently started building higher voltage 44 cell panels, and I'll describe those later in the seminar. I've already spoken to heat. Heat, these panels do not operate off of heat. They operate off light intensity. So just know that you start off with that 18 volt or 17 volt 36 cell panel, and it's running at that voltage rating is established at those standard test conditions. And if that panel is running two or three times hotter, I've measured as much as a 2 volt drop. So that 17 volt panel is now a 15 volt panel. And you've got to get through all the wires, connections, and controllers, and fuses, and to your batteries with enough voltage to make it up to 14, 1, 2, or 3 volts. So We'll get into this in a bit. Okay, now the amperage, that's what charges your battery. Voltage is pressure. That's what pushes the amp, okay? Think of a water tower full of water. The taller that tower is, the higher that tower is, the more water pressure you have, okay? The higher the voltage of the solar panel, the more pressure you have on the solar panel to push those amps into your battery. The amperage is very much like water flowing through a pipe, or, you know, water moving through a stream is called a current. It's the same thing in electricity. Amperage is a current, a moving electron, if you will. You see the symbol. So, anyway, the amperage is, your batteries are rated in amp hours. When I was talking earlier, this guy was talking about how many amps that fan grew and how many amp hours a day that we talk to run it. We're talking amps and amp hours all the time. So this is what actually is going to your battery and replacing what you can do in it. So light intensity, if you were, you would consider today to be a pretty bright day, wouldn't you? Okay. So the reality is it's about 80% of what these panels are tested at. I had a light meter before I came here. I held it out. Clear blue sky. It's essentially noon right now. Solar noon. Say I say 1 o'clock is solar noon. That's about 800 watts per square meter. Not 1,000 watts per square meter these panels are tested at. So just know that when you buy a solar panel, it's not that they're trying to deceive you. They had to come up with a way to measure inside the factory so that all panels would be equal when they come out and you compare them. But in the real world, you're only going to usually see, you know, 70, 80, maybe 90% of what you bought. Because of the rain that lay on the roof, pollution in the air, water vapor, dust in somebody's power field, exhaust. If you're in a city, it gets worse. So, anyway, the intensity of light affects the amperage. If you have a bright day and you're getting 1,000 watts per square meter intensity, you'll get the full rating of your panel. But the traffic's bright out there, you'll get half of what that panel says it'll deliver as far as amperage. That's the reality. Dead shade, as opposed to shade from a distant source. Yeah, dead shade, like a leaf fell off a tree and landed on your panel. That dead shade is very detrimental to the output of the solar panel. A solar cell in light produces electricity, but in the shade it turns into a resistor and burns it up in heat. So you know that, hey, it's really bright outside, and I'm not seeing the kind of amperage I think I ought to. You might simply go up and look at the panel and see if there's some debris on it. Well, that's the always after one nodding head doing here. Wake up! Now, why I pointed out the difference between dead shade and let's call it light shade, a tree that's over there, you still have some light bouncing off the clouds and water drops or something coming in. It's not dead shade. You will lower your output, but you won't just kill it like dead shade will. To my surprise once, you know, I pulled into a park at the end of the day, and I had to park without hookup under an elm grove. And it was dappled white. The wind was blowing, the trees were really big and up in the air, but there was this dappled light dancing around on the roof and the ground around me. And I went inside and I was still getting a third of the potential of being in full sun. So that's not necessarily absolutely detrimental to the output, it's just reduced output. So there's a difference between dead shade and light shade. Angle of incidence. That's a fancy word, huh? If your solar panel is laying flat on the roof, and the sun is straight over there, perpendicular to the panel, that's not excessive. Can anybody tell me when And North America, the sun is directly overhead. Summer solstice is a wild land, so that's the higher. You have to be within 20 degrees of the equator to ever see the sun directly overhead. Even in the summer, you come near at an angle. And in the winter, it gets worse, especially the farther north you get. Why do you think everyone gets Arizona or Florida or something in the winter? Because if you're up north and the earth is curved, that sun coming in like this and it's cold. You get over that curve, you can pick up more sun down in Arizona than you can in Minnesota. That's why that's a desert and that's snow, okay? So, it changes, okay? Right now, down flat on your roof in the winter, you're going to lose 30-40% just simply to reflection. That's why you'll see a lot of times people tilt those panels up in the winter to intercept more squares. You can increase the output in the winter 20-30-40% by tilting your panels up, as long as you tilt them to the south. Okay. Trust me. I figure I'm here to stick them out when you're pointing east, so they'll get it in the morning. And, it's better to be in the flat. Let them reference some labels here. You're buying panels by the lot. As soon as that's me, you're buying it by the amp delivery, but that's not how it works, okay? In this case, I'm going to take a generic 75-watt panel. And you'll see something on the label that's going to say PMAX or peak power or something like that. Maximum power, peak power, you'll see something to that effect. And it'll give you a wattage rating. Then you're going to see something called voltage at maximum power, or it might be voltage at peak power, VMP or VPP, okay? Now that's the operating voltage of the panel at standard test conditions, which I told you in the real world, okay? Then you're going to see something called amperage at maximum power, or amperage at peak power. And for the life of me, I still haven't figured out why this isn't an A. Okay. I think it's back there or something like that. Anyway, just accept that's an amp, okay? Alright. So this is again that standard test condition. If you were to multiply that times that, it would get really, really close to that. Both times amps of watts, okay? What means nothing to you unless you're testing, what's called voltage at open circuit, or open circuit voltage. Now that is the voltage of the panel without moving any amps. In this case, roughly 21-22 volts, depending on the manufacturer. If you were to call me up and say, I can't tell if my solar panel works, I'll say, do you have a voltmeter? If so, take the wires off the back of your charge controller. Hook it up and see if you see 20, 18, 20, 22 volts or something. Then I can say, okay, the wire is feeding the panel. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that panel is delivering amperage. You also have to do what's called short circuit amperage. And that amperage is out voltage. So then you switch your meter to amperage, and I trust that your meter is large enough to measure the amperage potential, and we will go over that if you call me, okay? But then if you measure some pretty good amperage, then I can tell you your problem isn't between the charge controller and the solar panel, it's somewhere else, okay? So that's for testing, not anything to do with what you can expect out of your solar panel. Let's talk about now. There are various types. There's plants, there's V's, there's sinuses, and then there's tilting, which I alluded to. And then how do you attach these mounts? And we'll go over the tilting stuff in a bit. I have some pictures down there. But I want to talk about attaching. If you have a rubber roof over plywood, you have one choice, and that's to screw it down and use caulk. All right? And it has to be a caulk that is not compatible with your rubber roof. You do not use silicone on the rubber of the roof. It's a chemical incompatibility. You'll start generating gas bubbles underneath the rubber, and your rubber will start bubbling up and stuff. So you only use certain fields. If you have a smooth, emphasis on smooth, fiberglass or aluminum roof, you can use this stuff called 3M Very High Bond Double-Sided Sticky Tape. This is not the tape you buy to hang pictures on the wall from Kmart or Walmart, okay? This is a special formula tape that outperforms spot welds and rivets. Alright? I've been using it for over a decade and I have yet to have a single failure. Using the tape prevents penetrations in your roof or potential for leaks also. But you can't use it on the other roof, can't use it on the textured roof. You got to clean the roof really good with rubbing alcohol or acetone or something to get rid of all waxes and oils and stuff. And you have to make darn sure that's where you want that solar panel when you put it on your roof. Thanks for moving after that. We've got a lot of work. This is what's called a flat top. Can you guess what kind of a cell this is? Amorphous, because you can't really see the pink grain boundary. In this case, this is molded right into the frame. There's some of that special sealant that Dicor is one brand, D-I-C-O-R. That's all well and good if you have a very narrow panel and a very flat roof. What happens if you have an airstream? Or some round, most rigs have a slightly rounded roof to drain water, okay? So those aren't always practical. And because of that, they just would like to slice a little piece out of it and call it a Z-foot. If you look at it in variety, it looks kind of like a Z. It could easily be an F foot, too, if you look at it from the other side. But the terminology is Z foot. These are usually fairly inexpensive, and they go off real easy. You just bolt them to the back of your panel. When you set it on the roof, you put a bed of that Dicor or if you use it to take, and then you screw it down. Now, what happens if you want to clean underneath that panel? Or lift the panel up later to check some wiring or take it with you that you're changing the rig in. And the tendency is just to pull the fruit out right there and take the panel off the roof. Do you think they still use marine grade plywood underneath that rubber roof?
Yeah.
They use a particle board or weighted strand board or something like that. Every time you run a screw in and out of that, it holds that much less and gives you a lot more potential for leaks. And I guarantee you, trying to undo that bolt in a 1-inch gap with gaining 2 inches is really not fun at all. I've done it way too many times, and I learned to hate those things. So we came up with something called a rocket propeller. And what we did is, it's not a really clear picture in this room, but there's this thing called a mount adapter that clips onto the end of your panel and then bolts to the back, and then we have an embedded nut in that thing. And you take this little foot, and you put it, that way you screw it to the side of your panel, and that does two things, actually three things. If your roof is rounded, those feet can pivot now and conform to the shape of your roof. If you have a roof with a little step in it, you can even stack it like this, and you have flexibility of where you come down. If you want to clean under it, and this is the same thing at the other end of the panel, which I have a picture here. If you're going to flip the panel over this way, you have to turn this knob about a quarter of a turn loose on both ends because that's your pivot point. That's your hinge. And then you take this one clean out, the one on the other side, and you can flip that panel over 180 degrees, clean under it, check your wires and the guns and bars that you have there, and put it back together. So it works quite well. And in the next slide, you can use this to tilt this way, with the use of a tilt one. You can put panels side by side and then run a piece of aluminum angle under it and then have those same occupancy. And once you zip them up, it looks something like this. Say, here's a single panel with a little rocker seat mount and a little film bar. Here's a double cracked up. I do not recommend this anymore. This was one of my first rigs here. My prior rig. The wind comes up. Doesn't that look like a sail? I thought I was going to tip my RV over here. If I had screws instead of that 3MK, I probably would have ripped the screws out of the roof. Catch is just the wind. These are so close to the roof that the wind piles into the side of your RV and creates a little disturbance or an eddy. Have you ever seen a rock in the middle of the stream and the water piles up in front of it? And then you see that swirl going down the side behind it. So there's not as much sheer wind right there as there is up here, okay? So I don't recommend that, like there's no way around it. So let's move on to the wire harness. We are already 45 minutes into this, and my joint is you're going to have three runs if your system's done right. You're going to have one from the solar panel to what we'll call a combiner box, and I'll explain that in a minute. Then we're going to have from that combiner box to the charge controller, and then from the charge controller to the battery. Again, we'll talk about this combiner box. We'll talk about fusing and we'll talk about wiring. Each panel should have its own stranded output wire. Okay? A lot of people do what's called a daisy chain. They'll take one panel, take a pile of them in, feed it over to the junction box, talk to the next panel, tag into that, take those two panels output into the next junction box, tag it in there, and so on and so on. It's called a daisy chain. If you're only doing a couple of panels, that's probably fine. But where you run into trouble is when you get to that third or fourth panel, and inside the junction box on the back of those panels is a bus bar or a terminal strip that's only rated for 15 amps. You keep piling the panels on, you get beyond the rating of that terminal strip, and you will literally melt it down and get nothing out of your system. So it's better to have each panel have its own output cable carried to the combiner box that you print. That cable is going to be laying up in the front, so it should stay somewhere on it, some high resistance. Otherwise, ultraviolet is going to break it down, it's going to start cracking, corroding. You'll have a problem. And if you don't have that, then you better at least wrap it in like this split one, using your system split one. Protect the jack of the wire. It should be a gauge appropriate for the average of the panel, UV resistance, or cover the split. Now the combiner box, we had to come up with some way to combine them, and we came up with one that sits underneath the refrigerator vent. It has four standard half-inch knockouts, and inside is nothing more than a couple of buzz bars. You can't really see it, but there's a plus sign there and a minus sign there. So this gives you a way to get all your panels to one point, and then this hole right here is the wire that will go out to your charge controller through the back of the refrigerator. That's one way. There's yet another one that I don't have to apply to them, but. So from the combiner box to the controller should also be stranded, but you need to make sure it has an abrasive resistant jacket. There's always sharp pieces of stuff that's going to be dropping around and dragging over. You might have to drill holes through, stuff with some cold wire. So you need a jacket that's not necessarily UV resistant, but it should be abrasive. And it needs to be the size big enough to carry the combined amperage of all of your solar panels, plus the same called end-to-cloud effect. You need a 25% margin. clear sunny day like today, you get direct sunlight, and so those light fluffy clouds around the perimeter of the sky, and they act like mirrors. So the sun is also bouncing off of those clouds being focused in on your panel. This is a very well-known and understood thing, and you just have to allow for it. There are times when your solar panel will produce 25% more than what they were rated at, because of the cloud effect. So when you're sizing your wire, sizing your fusing, buying your starter controller, you always need to leave yourself a 25% margin, because if you don't, you might blow a fuse, lose a fuse blowing control. You wonder what happened. Did this hit a point that blew the fuse? It might only be for a few minutes. If you're having leaks of 70 to 90 degrees, maybe temperature range, anything you can touch with your hands, like clothes, can only see 60 degrees C. That's about 140 degrees Fahrenheit. Can be in your refrigerator then. It's usually wrapped with insulation because of that rule. You don't want to touch that chimney and leave sizzling some sweat spots. Okay? So they wrap it in something that will bring it down below 60 degrees. Well, if your wire is dangling somewhere near it, then it'll be raised higher than 60 degrees, or you're going to have some trouble. Remember I told you all the problems during the wire time, so you're starting to see what I'm talking about here? Here's a big one, strain relief. Some people, especially the people that just give you a flat rate and do a real cheap, they just raise the wire from one point to another, and it might be swinging as you go down the road, or jarring, or bouncing, like a jump rope or something. And wherever you have a connection, you're putting strain on it. So they have these little wire ties that have screw eyes in them or something. Zip it around your wire, screw it off about every foot or two or whatever is appropriate to immobilize that wire, and you'll get rid of a great number of your problems down the road. Solar to the battery, you're still inside, out in front, but you see all the same things as the, And characteristics, one, needs to be as short a run as possible to prevent or reduce voltage drop, as we'll talk about here directly. And it should be as large a wire as practical, but also slow down or minimize voltage drop. Let's talk about voltage drop. The loss of pressure of voltage from resistance to electrical flow. Let's go back to that water tower. If you had a, you see the pipes coming down off of those things, are like this, okay? And the main coming under the street to your house is big around. So you have a half inch or 3/4 inch garden hose. Which one of those, the little small diameter garden hose, is going to present a lot more resistance to the flow than a giant pipe? It's the same thing with wire. The bigger around that wire is, the less resistance to that current or the electricity flowing through it. So that's why I was saying the bigger wire is practical. Problems of voltage drop, undersized wire, as I just explained. And the problem with undersized wire is self-perpetuating. Friction creates heat. Heat creates more friction, more resistance. So you get a wire hot, produces even more resistance, which makes it hotter, which produces, you get the picture, okay? So don't camp on the size of the wire. Fuses and fuse holders, fuses by their very definition are create voltage drop, because it's a small piece of wire that's designed once you get past so much amperage, it melts down. So there's voltage drop across the fuse, too. Fuse holders are usually mass-produced, clamped together, shrunk up in some kind of plastic or something, and the connections are not always well made before they wrap in plastic, and they prevent resistance too. corrosion at your wire connection, particularly down your battery, where some of that battery acid comes out, lands on your wires and terminals, creates corrosion. That puts up resistance and creates all these drops too. Forming any wire connection, you can make a press connection, and maybe you only grant one out of 30 some odd strands of wire. You can still measure the voltage, but current won't go through it very well, and it'll get really hot. So, remember about solar panels? I was talking about you need at least 17 volts or so, because the heat alone might put it down to 15, and then you've got all of this stuff contributing to voltage drop. And there's a big number of systems out there that are incapable of reaching the gas injection of the battery because of all this. And because the panel isn't the right voltage, that's why I'm telling you our heat has a unique operating environment. Blocking diodes, other electrical components, and the charging equipment also create voltage. Anything that creates heat, that's a voltage drop. Bring through this, and our mothers can go this. There's a very well known drop per amp per foot. Every amp going through every foot of wire creates X amount of voltage drop. Okay? I'm going to point it out. We're going to study geometry. You know, close to a couple of hundred watts of solar panels, then you're delivering 10 amps. And the charge controller is 10 feet away from your battery. Okay? Just as an example. And that current, that's really 20 feet.
Yeah, it's over the controller to the battery and then back.
Okay, so I've already accounted for that. This is how far the controller is away from the battery. If you have number 12 wire, you can expect a third of the volt drop. Now, if your charge controller is set for 14.3, let's make it simple, 14.32, and the controller is measuring that voltage at its terminal, and you're losing that 3.2 in the wire, the controller thinks the battery is at 14.32, but the battery is really at 14 volts. You see that voltage drop at work. That same 10 amps, the controller is 20 feet away, all of a sudden you're losing twice as much, two-thirds of the volt. All that's the all of the complete volt is the 30 foot away. The 12-gauge wire carrying 10 amps. What if that was 20 amps or 30 amps? There's a number of situations where your controller and what you see on the gauge tells you you hit the gap in threshold, but the reality is if you go out and measure your actual battery voltage, it isn't going to be there. And then 10 gauge is better, 8 gauge is better, 6 gauge is better. It's backwards, isn't it? The bigger the wire, the smaller the mountain. Okay? That's a success, and I won't go there. Reasons and circuit breakers, make sure the DC rate is direct current can lead the prop gap. You may knock out a fuse, but if you got enough amperage and voltage, it can just jump right across like it wasn't even there. Remember in the old Frankenstein movie, those two wires going up and arc of a light in between the wires moving out. Well, that was direct current, okay? It doesn't necessarily need a path. Look at light, that's direct current also. There's no giant wire hanging down from the sky, but it seems to find its way. Fuse set, that code set, keep them within 18 inches of your battery. That's so you blow the fuse before you short the battery out. The fuse is 20 feet away, and there's a short between the wires. The fuse isn't going to blow. You're going to short out your battery, and that's really dangerous. There's hot wind and shrapnel flying all over when your battery blows it up. Find all the amperage of your wire. And don't use a fuse breaker that's rated higher than the amp capacity of your wire, otherwise your wire becomes a fuse. Okay? There's no known rating depending on the type of wire and stuff. And likewise, you want to know the rating of the fuse holder, if you're going to use like a blade fuse holder or something. Negative.
you don't buy a 20-amp rated fuse holder, take a 20-amp fuse out and put it in 30. That's what I'm saying. Otherwise, the fuse holder becomes a fuse. Wire connections. Recommended practices. Make really clean, tight connections to protect them from the elements. The best way is to solder them together and use glue fill string through over. And put the glue fill string through on the wire before you solder it together. This sounds like a molecular experience. not too many people are really good solderers. So, second best thing would be to use a thing called glue fill string through string connector. Make sure you have a proper tool where you're installing those to make a good trim. I'll show you a picture of these in a bit. You also want to provide a trim for these wherever possible. Remember I told you about moving down the road and things, jerking and pulling, and you know, if that wire is tied off, you're not going to stress those connections. What is recommended, put the wire together and wrap them with an electrical tape. Not that that doesn't work, but it's always a problem down the road. It's good and a quick fix. The other thing is wire mess on transit wire in moving vehicles. Not that you cannot do this properly, but it requires a junction box screwed somewhere that has trailer leaf on it. The wires go in, you clamp down the wire, then you make your connection, then you put the lid on the box. Most people just twist two wires together and stuff in the wall. Now that's what I'm telling you is not right. I can't tell you, well I can, it's been less than a dozen, but I have gone in troubleshooting and found insulated wire connectors that the insulation was totally melted off of, and the paneling right around that was charcoal. And we're ready to burn these ribs right to the ground. So I just tell you, don't do it. There's better ways. And if you do use a wire nut, make sure you use a junction box and string leads in the cover. Here's what those glue fills, this is what it is before. You stick the wire in, you trim it down, you see the little dimple in there. When you heat it up with a heat gun, which is a glorified hair dryer, okay, it'll melt that down around the wire and uses a little bit of glue out. So now no moisture can get in here to cause corrosion. It also got a mechanical strain relief as well as that glue helps a little bit too, okay? And then on the butt connector, same thing on there, be a wire coming in this end also. So these things cost five times what just a plain old insulated one cost. But you only do a half a dozen of these things, it might cost you an extra $2 or $3 to do it with these things, okay? So again, all 10 pennies on the wire line. Now here's where I really want to be at, because I've done some serious testing of this kind of stuff here. Primary function is to prevent overcharge. Let's say it's cold outside, you don't get any voltage drop on that panel, and they did run it at 17 or 18 volts. You don't want to take your batteries there, okay? So you need something to stop it or slow it down once you get to that gallon threshold. That's the primary function. It's available in three different basic strategies, and I'll show you the differences here in a minute. The on-off, this is called Quincy Shunt, it'll take you up to a certain set point, which is usually that 14.2 or 3, something like that, and then it turns off. And the way it turns off is it shorts out your solar panel, okay? And that requires a blocking diode to keep shorting batteries at the same time. A blocking diode is like a one-way valve for electricity. So, after it reaches that 14.3, remember I told you about voltage drop? Your battery might actually be at like 13.8 or 9 or something. It'll turn off, and then it waits until your battery voltage falls down to somewhere around 12.8 or 9 or 13, depending on the manufacturer. Then it turns back on, goes back up, turns off, on, off, on, off, and never finishes the job because he holds the job, and I'll tell you that in a minute. The way to get around that is to use what's called false width modulation or a tapering chart. Now the reason I have true underlined is I've noticed popping up in the marketing on the on-off controllers a phrase called low frequency false width modulation. Okay? What we're talking about is high frequency. It's still on-off, but it's doing it hundreds or thousands of times a second. With the effect being, it'll take you up to that 14, 2, 3, something like that. You still have that voltage drop in there, but remember, voltage drop is directly related to how many amps are flowing through the wire. So if you don't turn off the controller, if you got CMS going, you still got that voltage drop, but as that amperage tapers off, so does the voltage drop. And so it's slowly, slowly, slowly brings you up to a very digital finish charge, and it just kisses the edge of that gap and threshold, finishes the job, drives all the sulfur back in, stirs up your electrolyte, and you finish charging your battery. So the tapering charge of the true voltage modulation gets the job done. Okay. There's a new chip out there in the last few years called current relief. The cannabis is soon exposed outside, that panel is 18 volts. You've had that furnace fan running all night, your battery, you're at 11.8 when you wake up. I mean, you've got this disparity in the voltage. The panel voltage is way up here, your batteries are way down here. With a current relief controller, they can grab that extra voltage and through what, in essence, a DC to DC converter, lower that voltage and increase the amperage. That's the boosting, current boosting effect. And they're all tapering charge controllers to which they've just added this boosting effect. It's most noticeable when the difference between the operating voltage of the panel and the battery is the widest part. As the sun heats that panel up, it creates that voltage drop, and the panel is operating at lower voltage, and as the battery charges up, that disparity changes, and so you don't get as great of a boost, but it's still there. And I'll show you this in a minute. Optimal features, temperature condensation, I spoke to when we were talking about batteries and what happens to that set point of battery temperature control. There's automatic equalization. Remember that hippie cloud effect I told you where you can produce 25% more? Some controllers put in a current limit on the output so that it will never go beyond the rating of the controller. So then you're not burning up controllers or blowing these fuses as a nuisance. Okay. Remember I told you I was a mad scientist in the beginning. Okay, well, I'm going to reveal myself now, okay? This is what I call installer's test band number one. You've seen those panels before. Inside of that rig is a board that has seven different charging colors on it. I'll tell you a little bit about this board so you'll understand when I flash through it when you're looking at it. Right up here are two gauges that are very accurately tuned to tell me exactly what the voltage of that panel is, what kind of amperage it's coming from. They're very precisely measured and set up. Right now, it's measuring open circuit voltage, which is at 20.7, and it's over here is the actual battery voltage measured through non-terrestrial wires, so it doesn't have any voltage drop in there. It's looking right at the battery. And this is what is actually being delivered to the battery. Well, since the solar panel isn't hooked to the battery, there's no amp going in. But what happens when I throw this switch right here is I tie the solar panel directly to the battery without a charge controller in it, okay? Well, each of these controllers has another switch that ties it to the solar panel and to the battery. So I can
flip this switch and see what would happen if there was no charge controller in the system. Then I could flip that switch off, turn these on, and see what happens when there's controls in there. You'll see that the battery is slightly lower than the panel.
That voltage, you got to have the panel at a higher voltage in order to push that amperage into the battery.
There's nothing low in there. It's only a tenth or two of a volt higher, but that's enough to switch it on in.
Okay, I love the back of this thing very much.
So these right here are very precise. These are tough. Management which are very accurate voltage drop measures, which can be translated into amperage. Anyway, that's the back. So let's move on. Let's test accuracy, okay? All right. Panel's operating at 14.2, putting out 11.3. This controller says the batteries are at 13.4. The actual batteries are 13.18. That's that voltage drop that I tell you about. You also see that we've lost the tenth of an amp. That tenth of an amp is running these LEDs over here. Okay? Now, that's connected to the voltage. The average, instead of putting 11.5 in, we're putting 11.4. Reasonably accurate, no problem there. Same company, different rate of control. You still see the same voltage drop. Only I turned off all those little LEDs and just using one, and you see that that tends to add one of these. You don't need all those LEDs on and talk to them. Okay, let's look at the amperage. This says 11.9, it's really 11.5. My point is, that these controllers over here are half the money of these four over here. You can buy components that are rated at 5% tolerance or 1%, and the more higher the tolerance, the more expensive the component, which is why these prices are different. Let's move on to this guy on the bottom, the no Siemens control. It's rated 13.3 volts, the battery's really 13.2, you still have that voltage drop, not so bad at this moment. So you're not losing any amperage here, 11.3, 11.3. But on amperage, this is rated of putting out 11.3, and it's really putting out 11.5, so this one went the other way. Mm-hmm. That's that fluctuation of those cheaper components, all right? Let's move up to Morningstar. The voltage check, 13.2. 13.24, we're getting into tighter tolerance components now. This is a good control. 11.9 coming in, 11.9 going out. It's not consuming any of the power. Ambridge is at 11.8. It's 11.9, pretty darn close, okay? That's acceptable to me. That's a high-quality, pulse-width, modulated, tapering charge control. Morningstar does a good job. Okay. Let's move down. Here is one of our earlier controls, the Uniotrope. Just to show you that I'm not afraid to show where we made mistakes, okay? The same voltage drop, 13.4, 13.2, 11.9, 11.8, we're consuming a little bit of power there. Now it's rated 12.1 amps, it's really 11.8. We learned from this that we were using a copper wire for a test that measured that amperage instead of that manganin material, which is more stable. It was less expensive to build, but it throws off accuracy. The more amperage you put through copper, the higher it gets, the more resistance it puts up, and the accuracy goes off. It gets generous, okay? it's telling you you're getting orbiting really high.
Now we'll look at the current movement control. This is written on the orbit. 13.29 for voltage, 13.25, that's pretty darn accurate, okay? That's a good control there.
What was
the name of
that one again?
That's a solar good. 2008. And it's 12.3, 12.3. Okay, that's the managing instruction there. We like this so much that we license the core technology, the air testing technology here. So I have Helicrow. We said, you know, I made a solar and Helicrow made charge controllers that I still have. That's what my lawyers do. You know, they have firewall between them.
Of course.
So anyway, that's a very fine. This is the first of the current movement controllers. He went to high accuracy, parts and components and stuff. Twice, a little more than twice as many of these over here. Just a stage more of that. So what I do is maybe things are quite there for RV for some of the reasons, and we'll get to that in a minute. So let me back up here. I forgot to show you something here. So that boosting effect, there's what's coming from the panel, 11 amps, there's what's going to the battery. So that's that boost effect, okay? This was our first prototype after we had licensed this technology. And 13.27 for voltage, 13.26 again, very accurate. That's hundreds of a volt there. The amperage, 11.6 coming in, 12.9 going out. There's a little disparity there. This was a prototype, ATV20. But you can see that boosting effect. You see that this all takes place within 5 minutes, okay? That's like a clock there, alright? And no, I didn't go and get there to the teeth. It's not my style, but okay. That was accuracy, okay? Now let's see what happens. This is what's important. What happens at the end of that charge cycle, alright? Now let's move into that. Right up here, this controller is 6.3 to 14.3, the battery is really at 13.4. Did it finish the job before it has turned off? You know it turned off, it sorted out the panel. You got 4/10 of a volt and some amperage shown here. There's nothing going to the battery except that it's actually consuming that 10th of an amp, which is this flow of light, okay? The rate is going from 12.8, since there's one current flowing, it's really accurate. 12.8, 12.8.
That voltage drop disappears when there's no current flowing.
But then it gets that 12.8, comes back on, goes back up to 14.3, it's still at 14.4, or 13.4. You never finish charging the battery. You never get to get up in rental. I watched this for hours. It never got there. Ever. I gave it 5 or 6 hours and never got there. Okay? I skipped this one because it's the same technology. This is 15 amps, this is 22. We're running out of time. This guy takes you up to 14.7. The values are really 13.5. And when it turns off, here's the zero. Here's that story of when I told you switching shorts out the panel to turn it off. It falls to 13.4, comes back on, goes back up to that number. So this one holds you at about 13.5. It's not moving up and down like the others, but it still isn't finishing the job. Here I want to point out paper charge on PWM now. This guy is taking you up to 14.5. There's still this voltage drop. But look at this right here. Pay attention right here too. 10 hours, 42 minutes, and some seconds there on this time. Now, a little over an hour later, it tapers down from that 11 strong to this 7.8, and you see this is creeping up. That's that taper. You taper off the amperage, voltage drop goes away. This controller will bring you up to the edge of that gasket threshold and finish the job. That's the true pulse width modulation. Okay. Look down, jump down to our older control, the RV 30. 14.2, really 13.9 at the gravity. Check out this right here. Okay. We did some, we recognized there was vulcan drop, so we introduced something we called automatic equalization. We gave you a half hour overcharge once you get to 14.2, which allowed the controller to go up to 15 volts, which took your batteries up to 14.7, well beyond that gapping threshold, performed a little short duration equalization. Then it falls back, turns off at that point, no amp flowing, but it didn't short out the channel. Just cut it off, okay? It opens up the circuit, you're seeing what the circuit voltage is. But now, it falls to this point, and then when it gets back to where it needs to come along again, it's back into that gapping threshold. So that was a good part of the controller, even if it wasn't deadly accurate. It gave you that little bump at the end, pow, and then you tapered off the amperage and you finished off with that gathered pressure. Let's look at the solar boost here. When Rick sends these out, he sends them out at 14 volts. So if he's doing out to mass distribution, he doesn't know what it's going up again. Remember I told you jail cells don't want to get any management mode, so they want to be solid at 14 volts. So Rick is real concerned that when he sends it out, knowing he doesn't want to burn out batteries. There is a means to adjust the voltage for your battery on the back of the controller, and it's described in the manual. So you can tune it. But my point here is, if you just took it out of the box and stuck it in the wall, and you had flooded lead acid or absorbed lead acid battery, you need to go in and just dial it up a bit to get to that gapping threshold, but you still have to let it here again. It's still the middle of the favorite car control. It's tapered on off to 13.6, moves up to 14, drops you up to 13.8. But because it stopped at 14, it didn't finish the job. That's fine for job cells. Good control, but you need to dial up to your battery if you don't have a job cell. But the first coming out of box 6. And here's the point, we dialed it up to 14.4 because we recognized that voltage drop. And it's at 14, and again, look at this amperage here. 7 going out, that's that boost of credit. Then tapering off, the voltage starts to rise here from 14 to 14.1 as this amperage goes away. I think there's one more in here. Goes away, orange, moves up a little more voltage. And that's that general finish charge, okay? If you'll get out of any four of these, the only tune that gives you that boost. Okay, now, I said, okay, now I understand how the control works. I want to compare very common systems out in the field that are installed in various places. So now you're looking at every test lab, okay? And this thing needs a lot of power, by the way. Here's what the roof looks like on that thing. So, this is Teosera, very high quality channel. Because I wanted 200 watts, I got 540 watt panels. They normally are sold at 1,200 watts. Back here is 200 watts of the ICD panel, a very widely distributed panel in multiple places. This is 900 watts, a custom made 44 cell panel. And that's 200 watts. These four right here, they're all wired together to operate a different controller in that we got. But 200 watts, 200 watts, 200 watts. I'll go inside this rig. This is in my cupboard over my bed, okay? This is no longer a prototype. Redesigned it a bit and took care of some of the problems we found. The way you're looking at here, this is my 44 cell panels with our current boosting control. This is the 200 watts of ICG with our upgraded control with the class labeled FDI control, the on-off control. So this is on-off, this is called current boosting, and
and this is a strand paper star.
Morningstar was a kid apparel, which is a very fine system.
So what you're looking at here is the amperage delivered to the battery. This is the actual battery voltage, 12.8. You can still see voltage drop, 13.2, 13.5, 13.4. Voltage drop is there, okay? It's how you finish the charge that deals with it. So, anyway, the battery during 12 days, all of those panels are on the same plane on the roof, on the same light, separate wiring system, down through separate controls, through the e-meters that measure all kinds of things. Right now, I'm measuring the average and amp hour delivered to the battery. So, 44 cell high voltage panel transmission control at this moment was delivering 13 amps to the battery. Let's call that 100%. Okay? On-off control with 200 watts of panel is delivering 10.4 left. So 200 watts is not always 200 watts unless that wire lines and that controller are the real important thing. Okay? Morningstar with a Kia Sierra 93. This one's in 7%. It doesn't have a boot, but that's not bad, folks. Considering there's no boot, if I had that system, I wouldn't complain of this, okay? You may not be getting the same effect as a higher voltage panel than a boot, but there's nothing wrong with these guys here. So, what was learned from that? These are my recommendations. We got about 10 minutes there. The solar panels, you should have a minimum of 36 cells rated at 14 volts or higher because of that voltage drop I told you about. You're going to be using current boosting controllers. That's why we built this extra 44 cells. Give us 4 extra volts over there. That's where that boost comes from. That's when you saw more effort going to the battery. Here in the same condition, same wattage, same battery. Okay? So, this does me no good at all unless you have a current boosting controller. You're just paying for 8 extra cells that do absolutely nothing for you unless you have a current boosting type controller. On the charge controller, if you want to use the papering or the current boosting thing, this is maximum power constraint, which is synonymous with current boosting, okay? Often referred to as NTPT. I threw it up for you to see that terminology, so that's what you'll see in ads and things. If you want to use temperature compensation, as I told you about batteries earlier, you need to adjust that set point based on the temperature of your battery. And that's usually an external piece of wire and a sensor that you take to the side of your battery, and it measures the battery's temperature, sends that information back to the controller, and the controller adjusts the set point accordingly. Okay? Wire harness. Minimum of 10 gauge wire for 1, 2, 300 watt system. Once you get to 3, 4, 5, 600 watts, better move to 8 gauge. This is just ballpark, and there's a lot of other factors. You get up like another panel light on my roof, and you want to put it all into one system, you got to get some heavy gauge wire. There are charts out there that say, I'm carrying this many amps, this many feet, through this gauge of wire, or, you know, what, how much voltage drop is. There's charts out there that help you figure out what you need. Keep a fuse or circuit breaker within 18 inches of the battery. Use that string tube to protect the instrument rather than use a little extra string or anything. What I learned is if you don't change your decision on dollars for lots of money. I showed you 3 200 watt systems that were each delivering different amounts of amperage to your battery. Go beyond wattage, okay? Look at the wire harness, look at the controller. Don't want to sell for the on-off controller. These things are like modern TV now. The concept there is no good of anything that will deliver amperage to your battery to offset what you should set a meter if it doesn't finish the job is way better than not having anything on the roof.
batteries have X number of cycle life. Okay? Get on off control, let your battery cycle down, come back on and off, on and off, and it shortens the life of your battery because you're cycling in minutes or recycle every few minutes. Okay? But that doesn't mean it's a worthless system. I'm not here really to put down that system. I'm here to show you what I've found and why we're doing what we do, because I'm an RV and I want to do business. Do not underestimate the importance of the wire harness. Again, this is where most of the problems lie. Voltage drop, torque connections, corrosion, energized wire, etc., etc. Always ask what the wire harness is. Okay? And don't underestimate if you're buying one of the saw yourself, you know, getting all the little blue film things, all the trim connections, all the brake transmitter, everything all in one kit, so you're not running back and forth to the hardware stores buying stuff that completes stuff. So those are the jobs. Okay, now the other thing is, if you have a controller that looks like that, the single best thing you can do is to upgrade to that. You notice how that same place, the exact same size, screw holes are exactly the right place. Same four wire hookup. I designed this specifically as an upgrade for that system. For another $40-$50, you can upgrade that and add in these switches over here. Okay? That's the mediator. And what you find out is that as an RVer, you're not always boondocking, you're not always closing the door down. If you have a control, let's press to that gasping threshold, let's get the good compensation, and you spend most of your time plugging the door power, you're not pulling those batteries down at night because your converter or your inverter charger or something is keeping the batteries up. So when the sun comes up the next day, like solar doesn't have to pull the batteries up to a certain point, hit the gas and threshold, and then taper off. Within an hour or two of daylight, you're at that gas and threshold, and you stay there all day long. And your batteries really don't want to be there all day long. So by simply flipping that switch from dry gas, I look at those blue dots, like this you flip it down to store power, and you drop it from 14.4 volts down to 13.2, and it disappears as far as your converter or inverter charger goes, which usually holds you up 13.4 or something like that. But if that store power ever went out, the solar is right there to come on when you need it, okay? If you're storing your rig in a barn, you want to disable the system because, you know, running LEDs and rig equipment displays and logic is a parasitic load holding on your battery. So you can just turn it off, okay? So you see how, you know, the solar booth was a great idea, but we've taken it and turned it to RVs right here, okay? So that's the difference. It's the same. You look on the board on the back, it says, produced under license by, you know, Blue Sky. So it's the same technology. Rick doesn't care. He makes money off every control I sell anyway. Okay, I wanted to send it for RVs. His main market is remote homes and grid internet, so he allowed me to do this. Rule of thumb, system price. Basic battery maintenance. If you have a trailer, fifth wheel, flat speed, you want a minimum of 50 to 65 watts to break even. You got gas detectors, you got various memories, you got self-discharge of the battery, if your refrigerator is on propane, it still has almost a 3/10 of an amp draw to sink and hold the cylinder valve open for the propane. Those of you who are more conservative consumers, this has nothing to do with your political bent. This means you only turn the light on when you need it, you turn it off when you don't. Kind of a thing. About a couple of 100 hours, half hours of battery storage.
Paragolf Park Avenue, 2, Group 27, something like that, and about 150 to 250 lots. I skipped this one. If you have a smart play, you need 85 to 100 lots, and I'll tell you why. In my brigade, that turns everything off, except for the twin breakers. And I'm measuring the parasitic load. I'm anywhere from 1.6 to 1.8 amps off 24 hours a day.
Where are we? Under the base panel on the ground? Luke 19:21 and right next door 19:23, but that's good enough.
Okay.
South side of the town, on the grass, come see us, drink it.